Now, I'm about to have a great conversation with a creative director, an academic researcher and lecturer. He is none other than Callum Knight, who is here today with Next in Vogue Singapore. Callum, welcome to Singapore. It's your first time, I hear.
Yes, very excited to be here. Yeah. Overexcited almost.
Yeah. And what do you make of it?
I mean, it's incredible. I, you know, kind of got off the plane, had to fight the jet lags, went on this kind of amazing walk and just, I don't know, that feeling so close to so many different cultures that I've been aware of, you know, growing up in the UK, but just seeing it kind of expressed in such a kind of melting pot. It sounds almost kind of cliche now, but it really is felt here, this kind of, you know, excitement at just how different things can come together. Yeah. And also the architecture is just so inspiring.
Incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah. And for a creative individual like yourself, obviously that's a lot of inspiration there,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yes, exactly. Kind of got, got a lot of photos on my camera roll, which I'd never show anyone because they're awful, but they always serve as good inspiration when I'm traveling back and thinking, wow, what was all of that?
Wow.
Like what all happened just there?
Incredible. So you basically do a whole bunch of different things. That introduction was about, you know, how you are a creative director. Not only that, you're an academic lecturer. And, you know, you have been involved in this industry pretty much since your childhood. Yes. We'll get into that. But tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I'm a creative director, which basically I realized was the easiest way to get myself into rooms that I was excited to be in. So as you say, like I've been around the industry since I was born. My parents both work in fashion. My father's a photographer. My mother is his close collaborator and kind of agent, lawyer, creative director. You know, like actually they, every image he does, she works on and is there and sees. So I used to find it very difficult that I didn't have my own medium. I used to, as I said, my camera roll is not great. You know, I found it quite a challenge actually to work out what my tool was. You know, I wasn't good at painting. I wasn't good at sculpture. Yeah. I wasn't good at a lot of the kind of more formal arts. And I found that frustrating for a long time until I kind of worked. But I was great with people. I could, you know, I could talk and I could work with my dad from a young age and I could, you know, I was on set the whole time and that felt really natural, but I couldn't find my role there until I kind of realized that actually my material is people, my material is teams, and my material is imagery, not taking it, but actually working it as a raw material into something larger, you know, and we all have those images that did that to us as children, that became kind of, that stuck with us in a different way. So that's kind of what creative direction means to me, but it really is what you make of it. And that's what's exciting, but also slightly difficult when it comes to explaining what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. It sounds like you do just about everything. So that's amazing. So now, obviously, your father, you talked about him. He is none other than fashion photographer Nick Knight. So how has the world we live in today so transformed from, you know, essentially it's transformed what he used to do, which was take photographs of great, amazing fashion images, to what you do right now?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's really the introduction of technology that has kept dad working in the way that he does and so excited. And we had a conversation yesterday at the conference where he zoomed in. And we were talking about this role of an image maker rather than a photographer. And I think he has spent his career iterating and proving this concept and moving away from fashion photography, you know, the kind of Avedon, an incredible legacy, but very much attached to the kind of mechanical apparatus of a camera, you know, and you Sontag theory and like, you know, all of that kind of builds into the idea of a photograph. Yeah. Whereas what dad started to do around the time that I was born, working with Photoshop and then going into 3D imagery, it doesn't really work in the same paradigm. So we needed new, frameworks to do so. So he iterated those as I was growing up and I was around those and saw how that wasn't just him in a dark room, that was him collaborating with McQueen, with Galliano, with Yoji and live streaming, you know, this idea of the kind of lonely photographer is not the one that I know. But he had to labor to prove that, whereas I feel very lucky that I don't need to prove that. So I can take that and just run with it as a platform. So
brilliant.
That's where, for me, I start to get involved in kind of the more conceptual academic side of things. So starting to say, okay, well, what does this mean outside of the studio, outside of the magazine? How does this start to impact in these new third spaces we have, you know, online and, you know, kind of
which you have a greater understanding of, obviously, because you are young and you grew up with social media and technology and the internet. So the way you interpret it is very different from the way, you know, the previous generation might have done. So how has it transformed just essentially this whole fashion world?
I mean, I think it's like, it's almost, it's chalk and cheese, it's black and white. You can't really compare the two. I mean, my academic research, which obviously is so inspired by my personal, you know, by my creative practice, is really looking into kind of this like paradigm shift of how these digital networks, which is what I refer to as, you know, obviously social media, but also the internet at large, and just this fact that we are all connected in some way now. It kind of changes really what it means to, it can change what it means to be human, and actually how we start to understand and interact with our own humanity and our own selfhood. So kind of looking at those ontological shifts, but, and then bringing that back into fashion, that's, you know, working with the Met to explore how they can use technology to inspire audiences to understand not just the beautiful craft and dates of when these garments were made, but how they're made, how they moved, how the light hit them, you know. And so it's bringing that kind of conceptual, theoretical kind of drive and applying it to the kind of image as a tool to kind of really drive something home that feels, you know, that you can just enjoy the imagery that I work on and that I make, but actually behind it there is a really high proposition of what the future can be.
Yeah,
I think we forget how interlinked the present and the future are. You know, I work, you know, around tech quite a lot, and we get quite consumed with talking about how AI or Apple, you know, well, it's always talking about the future, but we have it now. And actually our futures are obviously mitigated in our presence. So we have to kind of not get distracted by thinking about future with VR and self-driving cars or whatever, because we have it now. And actually the tools are applied
to work
now.
With it now.
Yes.
And that's what you're doing essentially. And of course, you know, talking about social media, it's so much part and parcel of our lives today.
Yeah.
And for young people's lives, and you see it being transformed all the time. How would you say, you know, the algorithms that are out there, how are they influencing our lives, not just in fashion and images, but also beyond?
Yeah, I think my research really kind of uncovered this almost by accident. I mean, and I don't think it's, I think most people understand that what I found was these algorithms were kind of almost replicating different systems of oppressions that we have in what I refer to as the atomic world, because I don't want to say the real world as compared to the digital being not real, because I think that does a disservice to some of the powers of these networks, and also some of the lives that are truly lived online. But what happens is in the same way systems such as class, like gender, like race, can control what an individual does and doesn't experience in their day, in their lives, algorithms do the same of controlling the way we navigate our networks. And that actually are real world implications to what happens when you transgress or try and escape those. So working with a select group of queer practitioners, kind of artists who work really on the forefront of, you know, it's not performance art, it's not imagery. They use their selfhood and explore that online digitally for a mixture of CGI, of AI, of, you know, documentation. What happens when they transgress through the kind of taxonomic view of this, of these algorithms. And it sadly does, you know, there's examples of these images being taken and systematically through the algorithm being shown to people who will respond negatively to them and threaten violence, kind of try and deplatform these, you know, these creatives. And that is a system that is going on online and happens systemically. So it's
how do we stop something like that? I mean, or is it just innate and it just happens?
I don't think it's innate. I think we have to really start to, this is again why the I'm doing this research is to answer that question. And I think we really need to have a kind of shift, a paradigm shift in how we see these networks and how we see how we engage through them. So I talk about navigation as where we have human agency, like we choose whether we go left or right on the network, and that's where we can start to understand our own power. Because at the moment, the, you know, what's referred to as a corporate platform complex, a couple of companies that really own most of the places we interact on digitally, kind of tried to get us to look away from some of the bits that we leave behind and say, oh, well, don't worry about that, you know, but it's making people a lot of money. There is a lot of value to it,
absolutely.
But we're separated from that value. So,
collecting your data. It's a mine. It's a gold mine, isn't it?
It is. But there's lots of amazing practitioners, some of which are here this week, working in this space. And, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about the kind of research is that I get to build my own language, and language is such a key tool. Yeah. But actually, when you sit down and really think about some of these concepts, lots of artists and practitioners are talking about the same thing, but they're using their own language for it. But once you start to get a sense of some of the dangers and some of the desires of kind of bringing back agency online, there's actually a lot of work going on moving quite quickly against kind of automated decision making online that is non-transparent and harmful to individuals. But me personally, I think before we can start to engage in that, we need to societally start thinking, well, okay, the internet isn't a dead space. And just because I don't physically change when I go online, I'm leaving parts of myself there, and I need to start to bring more humanity online.
I hate to say this, or think about ways to protect yourself as well when you're out there, because it is the wild, wild west of the internet and social media. So, I mean, I guess that leads me to my next question, which is just how has technology changed and transformed how we consume culture, how we consume fashion, how we consume fashion images, which is very much part and parcel of what you do, and just the nature of consumption in itself, because it has done, hasn't it?
For me, it has completely changed it. And I hear a lot of people kind of bemoan the change. And I think, you know, there are issues when it comes to people who, or places that like to look backwards, right? You know, like there's so much energy spent on bolstering up old narratives of the 80s and 90s and 2000s in fashion, when actually we need all eyes on right now. Because if we spend all our time looking backwards, then what happens to the future, you know? So I find it incredibly exciting. And I think the way that things have changed is our audiences have become literate in the aesthetics of luxury and don't need photographers and stylists and designers to necessarily mitigate their relationship to it. It's become more open source. And at the moment, that's a bottom up desire.
Yeah.
But I think, like, you know, look at things like Brat, for example, the Charli XCX album. Yeah. Like, that rollout was so successful because instead of just delivering high value aesthetics that you could, you know, buy the same handbag as Charli, she engaged her fans in a more open source. Like, she gave them the tools to make Brat themselves. Obviously they weren't making the music, but they could attend things, they could get involved in the graphics, they could get involved in the front, they could reattune that attitude and see things in their daily lives and give that, you know, their own twist. So I think
so that interactivity, that ability to talk to the people who follow you, to your fans, is really crucial, isn't it?
I think it's really crucial because, you know, before, like when Dad would do Dior in the early 2000s, he would do 6 images that lasted 6 months and they'd be on billboards for 6 months and they could hold that weight on their shoulders. Whereas now brands are posting 6 images a day and they don't even matter for that moment. And I'm not here to say that that's awful. That is just the way that things are.
Yeah.
But what we start to see is now images, instead of being these standout standout moments, they almost become a culminative language.
Yeah.
And actually it's about the long term and how you let people engage with that on we have access to people in a very different kind of temporal spaces as well online. So I get too theoretical.
No, please do. I'd love to learn more. This is such an education, and it's an education for all our listeners as well. Because you're right. I mean, a piece of as you say, those moments that your father captured for Dior were pieces of art, weren't they? And they lasted and they had longevity. Whereas now, I guess what you're saying is, there's still art out there that's being created, but it's just a lot less, it's a lot more transient. It's so much more ephemeral in terms of how quickly it changes.
It's really ephemeral. Yeah. And also it's, but that's not a bad thing. We just have to understand it as a new art form, you know, and it's not going to be able to be quantified in the, like, you know, I love fine art. I love modern art. Like, that's, I get a lot of inspiration there. But the things that I make wouldn't make sense in that world. And the things that I'm really inspired by wouldn't make sense in a white gallery, because they exist in a more engaged space and they make sense because they're on social media. So instead of saying, oh, well, that's not a legitimate space actually it is. Yeah. And if we just need to see those same networks as in the same way that we see, you know, Jay's White Cube or, you know, the Gagosian. It is there. It's just we're choosing not to see it. Whereas I can see that. And that's hopefully what my practice can start to do, is to start to get people to validate it. And that's not to say everything needs to be digital. You know, there's still like fine art painting is still an incredibly valuable resource and a way for us to render humanity. But this specific time that we live in, where imagery becomes the platform for communication between high art, commercial values, and community, that's fascinating as a new medium. So why not roll with it? And if it's not for you, then don't do it. That's cool. Like I would love, some brands shouldn't post every day, some brands shouldn't post every week. You know, look at Bottega, they don't have social media, they're doing fine. Like, it's, there's a kind of cookie cutter method that I think people took on because they were scared, because they had waited too long with Web 2.0, Web 2.5. Then you're now with Web 3, quantum and AI. People are kind of rushing at it almost without thinking about what it actually means to be a company that engages in AI or a company, you know, or why they're doing so. And I think technology isn't for us all to assimilate to whatever's new. That's consumerism. That's capitalism. We need, if we're in luxury, we have the luxury of not having to do things for the sake of doing things. And we should take that.
So give us examples of some of the projects that you've worked on where you're really bringing some of this knowledge that you have and some of the academic research that you're doing, and you're using that to, you know, obviously strengthen, to give vision to these projects that you're working on.
I mean, one that kind of, I think just finished, but actually finished a while ago now, was the Met and the Sleeping Beauties exhibition that I did with Dad and with Andrew Bolton, who's the head curator, their chief curator. Brilliant. And that was incredible because obviously they do these amazing show-stopping exhibitions where they bring kind of fashion language to the public, and they present clothes with that kind of like cerebral knowledge that they have. Like, you know, great information, like the most amount of access, the most well-curated pieces. And they show that also in a kind of way that makes it accessible to people. And that's why it's so successful. However, what Andrew wanted to do with this show was to use new technology to start to bring in other ways of understanding fashion. So instead of just, you know, when you get presented with a garment, usually it's the date, it's the designer, maybe a little bit of information about that designer within the curatorial theme. This was really to start exploring, okay, well, what other bits of information can we gather from garments, using them as data to be researched, and then show that to the audience in a way to get them to understand other parts of fashion that normally are lost through curatorial methods. So we you know, use CGI to remake a 200-year-old gown that had been worn, I think, to one of Mrs. Astor's balls. And, you know, we worked with their conservators there for, I mean, thousands of man hours making this digital garment that danced at a kind of traditional waltz of the time around the opening of the exhibition. So you saw a garment that was lying flat that could never be worn again, reanimated in, you know, in kind of digital eternity. And what that did was really bring this kind of the visceral side of fashion, because it is a communicative art form in itself, bringing that there. And, you know, so sometimes it was about bringing things back to life. Other times we were bringing the inspiration of garments back to life to try and pull some of the designer's original intention back, which obviously gets lost when you curate it, unless you put it in the written word. So just exploring, you know, how an institution can curate and inspire.
Gosh, I'd love your help at the Fashion Museum in Bath, where I am the co-chair of the Board of Trustees. We have an incredible collection of about 100,000 items on par with the V&A, including items that do date back to Shakespearean times. So yeah, if you could reanimate that somehow, we'd love it. It would be so extraordinary for viewers and people who come to the gallery. Now, really fascinating talking to you, Callum, because I am learning so much, and I'm sure the listeners are learning so much from you as well. Talk us through, you know, what it's like to, I guess, be part of a big family firm. Tell us a little bit about what the dynamics are when you work in a situation like that.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything else, so I can't compare it. I mean, I definitely had experiences when I was younger that I maybe found almost like too inspiring and slightly isolating in my childhood. You know, like I was saying on stage yesterday, I obviously used to go on set a lot. So, and they would go on pretty late sometimes. Yeah. So when mum and dad were doing Plato's Atlantis, which was McQueen's last collection, obviously I knew Lee, but I didn't spend a lot of time around him. He like wasn't that into kids, but I was 11, 12. Mm. So I was kind of like just not fully a child anymore. And that, you know, and so he kind of started talking to me and he could tell it's like 4 a.m. I was very tired. So to literally wake me up, he took me upstairs and talked me through the whole collection 2 weeks before it went up. So, I mean, fashion from, you know, try that telling that to your class of 12 year olds.
Incredible access that you had and the privilege to be with these people. Exactly. How amazing at such a young age.
So that was amazing, but maybe slightly isolating in my childhood because I was so, I loved fashion. I loved it so much. And, you know, but that also very much translated in me loving my parents and like loving that space and seeing them create. And I used to be at the back of the studio when I was very young and I'd see John and like Sam, who Sam at night did hair, and Val and dad and mum, and they'd all be making these images and you could kind of feel that they would transcend to the slightly higher place, which not to get too spiritual, but when I'm making imagery now, well, you do slightly lose track of your physicality and start to embody the image in a weird way. And like it sounds like slightly nut job when you try and explain it.
No, it sounds
but,
great.
You know, people talk about that.
It's so creative. Yeah.
People talk about that, like, you know, when you when you're making art, like you transcend into something else. And one of the amazing things about doing a shoot is you get to do that with a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I used to see that happen and I used to be quite confused about it as a kid. So getting to collaborate with my parents when I worked for them full time at the studio was like amazing, and now I still collaborate with them as a freelancer, but being able to know them not just as my parents, who they are and they're amazing parents, but also to know them as artists, like what an honor to have that duality of relationship. And also, you know, obviously I get asked a lot about my dad, but you know, my dad loves, because I get asked a lot about you, and to like also be seen by my parents in like as I kind of come into something which I've wanted for a long time and you know had my own struggles to find, you know, and finding that actually not in fashion, but finding that in academia and being able to bring that in. And, you know, also in my spare time, I'm a student of psychoanalysis. So I train in that.
Gosh,
and
what aren't you doing, Callum Knight?
Sleeping.
You seem to be doing everything. Amazing. But yeah, it just sounds like what a great, you know, ability to learn on the job. I mean, that education that you had, just being around such talented individuals from such a young age must have been just invaluable.
There also definitely was a lot of like, you know, and I'm not proud of it, but like a lot of guilt around the access that I had and, you know, the privileges that I have. One being like a white, straight passing guy who grew up in London. Like that already comes with a whole group of privileges. And then also working like for my parents, like in a nepotistic industry already. But one of the things that really was a turning point for me, not turning point, but like was when I realized that the worst thing I could do was feel shame and like hide. So what I try and do now through one, like my lecturing, when I go in and speak to students and also doing things like this, which are a pleasure to do, but make sure that I talk about the realities of what it's like and the access that I've had and what I've known, because I've probably unknowingly missed so many different like traps of what it's like to come up in this industry and also experience them too. So one of the things that's really important to me now is that I don't, you know, is that I acknowledge the privilege that I have in this industry and doing what I do, but also try and share all the knowledge that I've gained and been around, because otherwise that is, you know, that's the worst thing that I could do. You know?
No, it's so important to recognize that. And it's wonderful that you are. And obviously you've got this great interaction with your students. You talk about them. So so tell us about how your students feel about attending your classes and listening to your lectures.
I don't have like a set group of students. So I'm an associate lecturer. So that means I go in and I see like different groups all the time and they'll work on different projects. So I don't have like a set group of students, but I also am doing my master's. So I have students that I'm part of a cohort with and then I also lecture. So what, I mean, it's working with students is like incredible, you know, one, because we're actually a similar age. So we get, so they seem to respond quite well to me. And also I have to sit down. they show me all this work and they come with all this anxiety and all of that. And I have my own anxieties. I'm also like, oh yeah. God, am I going to get it? But I have to hear what they're saying, see what they're showing, understand what they want to be saying and showing, understand what's inhibiting them, process it, feed it back to them, and then have a conversation in 10 minutes. And a bit like you interviewing, like, you know, you have to hold quite a lot for people. And that's like an honor to be able to do and also great practice for me to have to do every 10 minutes with someone new. Yeah. So it's actually been really good training for like creative direction. So like now I laugh, like when I first started taking like meetings myself 2 years ago, I was awful at meetings. Whereas now I can like walk into a room and hold that space in that room.
I can't see that person. You're fantastic. You've come a long way in 2 years.
But, you know, so it's like I learn a lot from them and the conversations that I have. And, you know, and also just being able to be an outside voice. Like I'm not a full-time lecturer. Mm. And I think that's important because I think students always rally against what they know. Sure. But it seems that when I say things to them, and also especially if I can like validate an outsider perspective, like quite often there's students who are having a hard time with their full-time teachers, and I can talk to them about that and help them navigate that and maybe try and translate a bit of the feedback for them and also tell them, no, like, don't give up on that bit because that bit's strong. Yeah. Like, it's a real privilege to have this like light touch with the students that I don't know if I'd want to give up, but I definitely see myself teaching for a long time. Or like, it's not teaching, it's being involved.
Yeah, educating us all who don't perhaps know as much or haven't got that visual imagery that you've got down pat.
They show me so much. And like, to be honest, it's a bit like, it's a bit of a steal because then I get to be in contact with the next generation all the time. Yeah. So I'm always like, oh, well, you know, they'll be good for that. And I can always kind of, you know, you see talent coming up and it doesn't escape you. So
I have to say, being in touch with the next generation is part of the reason why I took on being a chancellor of Bath Spa University. Being around students is so extraordinary because they literally will be, you know, they are going to define what this planet becomes.
Yeah.
And it's so extraordinary being part of that next generation. You said you were in Asia for the first time, and that is amazing. What do you make of it all? And do you see your practice, perhaps some of your work, bringing you here?
Absolutely. Like, I've been so inspired by some of the conversations I've had. Like, it's, I mean, one, as I said, just being so... working so much in kind of Europe and in America, it's so amazing to feel closer to just different creative pools. And one of the things I've really learned is just to stay, you know, whether it's with students or in a new country or in a gallery, to stay really present and just like let things happen. And like being in new environments precipitates new things in yourself and new conversations. So all of that is an honor to be somewhere so kind of like radically different for me. And that's beautiful. And I don't take it lightly. But actually, I think the attitude, especially to technology and selfhood, has been fascinating here because there just isn't the same cultural fear of it in the same way. I mean, that's not to say there aren't real reasons to be scared, but there's not that kind of like, you know, there's a desire to engage, which I think is really important. And, you know, I'm banging my head against the wall, writing my thesis at Central St. Martin's, trying to like, you know, go back to square one so I can get people to understand. And then I'm here and there's a whole hour of conversation I normally prelude that I don't have to have because the conversations are just more developed.
Yeah.
So it's like exciting to be in a space where there's more traction. And, you know, I was here, I'm sad I missed it, but like the Proof of Personhood exhibition at the, I think it's the Singapore National Art Gallery or...
it's not Asian Civilizations Museum. I actually don't know because I haven't been here for a bit.
No, sorry. It was Proof of Personhood exhibition and the head curator was speaking yesterday.
Wow, okay.
And that was like fascinating because it's, you know, so much of what I'm like dying to find out information of is actually codified in institutions here. And they're like really exploring that and open to culturally asking questions instead of seeking... reassurance.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. Because I think you're right. I think Asia is kind of ahead of the game when it comes to embracing technology and perhaps not valuing privacy quite as much. People are quite happy to give that up because they feel like they're getting so much in return from, you know, technology and you know, a lot of the evolution of what you're talking about is really extraordinary. So, Callum Knight, you're still incredibly young. And you've got all of this incredible, you know, career ahead of you. So tell us, what is next?
If I knew, I don't think I'd be that excited. I mean, the next couple of months, you know, it's just finding the right projects. And I feel very lucky again. Like, I think because of that access and knowledge I have from my parents, not just to jump at the first things and to really like try and evaluate what I can bring to a project and why I'm doing it and why they want me, and, you know, just to make sense of that. So, and also to enjoy the time off and to enjoy the time just thinking about things. But I'm starting to get a bit itchy. Like, after the Met, I had summer, went on a road trip. I did all of that stuff. And then now it's, you know, now it's getting a bit like, oh, I want to start really making again. So, you know, I'd love to be, I love making imagery, and I love also prepping the ground for new images to be kind of like received. So that's kind of communication strategy, visual strategy. So it's like finding the right brands and companies that really want to take that on. And also explore, I'm in conversations about exploring some kind of physical spaces and how, I'm trying to work out what I can say, how to bring some of this kind of, I guess I have a very like ecological point of view on creativity, and how to maybe embed that into physical spaces a bit more. And so there's interesting conversations there, but as we all know, until it happens, it's not happening.
Brilliant. Now, there's a rapid fire round, which I'm told we're doing with all the guests. So I'll do a rapid fire round here where we learn a little bit more about you, Callum. So let me think. First question, very simple. I'll start off with something very easy. What's your favorite color?
It's really boring. It's gray.
Oh, why?
I don't know. It just always has been. I mean, it's gray or white. I grew up in a modern house, so it's all white and glass.
Yeah.
And I just think there's something white or gray. Gray, there's just so many subtleties and nuance and so much emotion. And gray is colorful compared to the white that I grew up in.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And that doesn't quite tie in with this extraordinary t-shirt you have on. Tell us about it.
Oh, it's just, I was saying before we got on, this was like the last Mark by Marc Jacobs campaign collection that kind of everyone went wild for in like 2013. And I begged and begged and begged to get it for Christmas. And I got it. And then I was too scared to wear it for some reason. I can't remember. It's just some, just some teenage image things. It was too loud or too something. It didn't. And then I found it when I was back at my parents' house like a year ago. And I was like, how have I not worn this?
Yes.
So now I'm wearing it with a lot of pride.
Good. I think you should wear lots of color. I think it's great. Okay. Another rapid fire question. One of your best memories.
There's so many. And so many that I don't know if I can quite translate why they're the best memories. But, you know, I'll go for one recent one. Like, on Wednesdays, the Met is closed to the public. So I, every Wednesday, would, because I had a staff pass, could walk around the Met empty and stand within Van Gogh's and Rodin's and just any, you know, the Asian, like...
Yeah.
I was reduced to tears. Like, that's actually being around that much
amazing.
Art, it is almost too much to stand in some of those rooms. Like, you understand why they need to be big and full, because it dissipates. It's amazing.
Oh, extraordinary.
So, I of memories of just, like, falling into those kind of historic pieces of
amazing,
work.
Amazing, amazing. Favorite city?
Hard, really hard. Depends on who I am that day.
Yeah.
But, I mean, London is always home.
Yeah,
London will always be my home. So if I had to choose one, it would be London. But every space that I enter, I try and enter in a way of understanding that I'm bringing something to it, and it's also bringing so much to me. Yeah. So everything has something to offer. You just have to find it, and also to understand why you don't like certain things as well. You know, it's okay to not feel always comfortable in a space as long as you understand why, and you're not just rejecting it because it feels new or different.
Yeah.
But I think it would have to be London. Okay. Sorry, I'm not very good at quick fire. It's like long theses.
I was told I needed to ask rapid fire questions, which is why I'm doing this now. And actually, I'm just thinking them off the cuff. So my next question would be probably, because we are talking fashion, I'm afraid I'm going to have to put you on the spot. Favorite designer?
My first, it's going to be John. Just John Galliano. I was lucky enough to work with him at the beginning of Margiela. I was a couture intern for 9 months. And the openness he has with his team has been incredibly inspirational. And I've been lucky enough to collaborate with him since in like a fuller capacity where I, you know, and every time he engages a team, the way he brings them together is just so magnetic and true. That then, and I think that that's so apparent in the work and how he, and how it kind of comes out and how he approaches fashion. So it, if it has to be one, it has to be him. But there are amazing, amazing talents all over the world.
There are. Yeah. That, which brings me to my next question. Favorite young and upcoming designer?
Who would that be? I mean, I love the work of Jawara Lane, based in London, kind of working between London and the Cayman Islands. And their work really looks at how fashion can be kind of like a force for new culture and new mythology. And it just, like, I love that theoretically. And also Sinead O'Dwyer and Michaela Stark, who are two designers in London who are making amazing garments that kind of take queer concepts and codify them through fashion and are starting really interesting conversations around body and what that means and what it means to create, what fashion can mean.
Yeah.
But there's also tons of really exciting stuff going on in New York. Like, when I'm going to forget everyone's names. There's really great stuff going on in New York. I need to spend some more time there because I haven't been since the Met. I need to spend some more time there because there's like 10 different, like 7 different brands. I'm like, oh, wait, that's really cool. I need to find out what's going on there.
Yeah. And I'm sure you will, Callan Knight. This has been such an extraordinary conversation. I have learned so much. I'm sure our listeners have learned so much. Truly enlightening meeting you and speaking to you today. Thank you, Callan.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening.